Penguin Random House Audio presents Under the Big Black Sun, A Personal History of L.A. Punk by John Doe with Tom DeSavia and Friends, and a foreword written and read by Billy Joe Armstrong. Dedicated to all the fearless misfits who made it through, those who didn't, and to ex-bandmates DJ, Billy, and most of all, Lexine. John Doe.
I'd like to dedicate this book to my father slash best friend, who let me waste all my money on records and put up with the noise that ensued in the hopes that one day I'd figure out how to make a living from it. Also, my eternal thanks go out to X for changing everything my 15-year-old self thought he knew about art. I remain eternally grateful to Billy, DJ, Xene, and John. Tom DeSavia.
Certainly more stories will be told about this era. To the best of our abilities, we try to tell what we know and what we can remember. It's likely that people and events have been left out, but that will be someone else's story. The different perspectives and voices here reflect the collaborative, adventurous spirit that defined the early punk rock scene in Los Angeles. We couldn't have and didn't want to do it alone. John Doe, Richmond, California.
Green Day finally made its way to Los Angeles for a gig in 1990. We were roughly 10 years too late for a scene that spawned some of the best bands ever. We played the god-awful Coconut Teaser on Sunset Boulevard. We were all under 21, so we weren't allowed inside the club. We waited our turn outside, sandwiched in between a strange lineup of bands that were all trying to get signed to a major label. The stage wrangler hauled us in, and we played our 20-minute set on borrowed gear. It was a good set, and people were genuinely into it, but before we got a chance to bask in the glory, we were asked to leave. And that was my first impression of Los Angeles. I sat outside the curb kind of sad. I wondered if maybe Xene or John would walk up and bum a smoke off me. Or just maybe Leonard and Stanley possibly caught our set. Or by some weird chance, Jane Whelan would invite me to a party at the Canterbury. Nope. None of these things happened. But what did happen was their music made its way to a painfully small town I came from in Northern California, and it made me want to slam dance my way out of it. Finding like-minded weirdos at the Gilman Street scene in Berkeley who also had dreams of almost hanging out with Darby Crash and the Lightbulb Kids in the decline of Western civilization. However, almost isn't good enough. You have to take whatever spirit is left and make it your own. History only happens for a second, and you have to do everything you can in that moment. Thank God for Alice Bagg, good Lord, and Pat Smear for that matter. The thing that makes these people brilliant is the fact that the music and ideas they created are still relevant today. Songs like Los Angeles, We Got the Neutron Bomb, and Lexicon Devil don't have expiration dates. And that's at a time when the entire decade of the 80s was a giant expiration date. These are the kids before the kids, and then there are the kids after that, and so on. I'm not much of a kid anymore, but I still have all these songs stuck in my head. So even if the Coconut Teaser wasn't exactly the mask, I still have all that graffiti in my brain. Imagination can take you a long way. Roughly, Billy Joe Armstrong.
Preface, Post-Apocalyptic Clowns by Tom DeSavia. I wasn't there, but it was about to change my life. Living in the suburbs outside of Los Angeles, punk rock was simply the scary legend that came from the big, dirty metropolis. Punk itself was kind of a pop culture mythology, proven only to exist by the desolate outsider occasionally spotted wandering our streets, causing the community to collectively clutch their pearls and pray they were just passing through. In our minds, these punks shared space only with the homeless and war vets, except they scared us more because it was obviously a rebellious choice they had made to live this way. Punk was dangerous, a gateway drug to a dark, violent world. This wasn't teenage rebellion. This was alarming, ugly, and threatening. The first time I became aware of punk rock was as a lad in 1976. There was TV coverage of the Sex Pistols in America. The only footage I recall was showing the audience spitting on this hideous band of post-apocalyptic clowns. The only reason I even recall it was because of the distaste it drew from my parents, and I couldn't have agreed with them more. It was disgusting, obviously immoral, and seemingly devoid of all melody. Also, they seemed angry, as did the crowd. It was shocking on all levels. The newscasters reporting enthusiastically agreed. I was young enough to be intimidated by the images that came over the local news channel that day, but just becoming old enough to begin to sort of learn what rebellion meant. Those images stuck with me strong, and I always associated them with my folks being so offended by this. Perhaps that's why I needed to find out more. More images started to creep in, mostly in the pages of the rock magazines I began to devour religiously, Circus, Cream, even Rolling Stone. I wasn't even 10 years old, but I was just starting to realize the world was a real fucked up place. Saigon fell in 1975, ending the Vietnam War. Hippies were turning into cultists and murderers. This Nixon guy seemed to have fucked up a lot of shit. Basically, it seemed folks were prepping for the arrival of Four Horsemen. In only a few short years, the hippies became unflinching, heartless businessmen. Greed was good, and Reagan would introduce Jesus Christ into the Republican Party. Combine that with pop radio so smooth that flute solos were replacing guitars, and you had a larger sect of the American mainstream ready to accept punk rock into their hearts, just as our compatriots on the other side of the pond had been doing for a few years. Looking back on that time, I suppose the hippies and the punks had more in common than they would have chosen to believe, especially back then. Political rebellion, the rise of counterculture activism, economic uncertainty, and eating art that spoke to these and other issues in an unflinching way. As the 1970s were starting to come to a close, suddenly the radio began to sound different. Songs by bands like The Clash, The Pretenders, Blondie, and Devo were creeping into our bedrooms, some even going on to become pop hits. I remember hearing DJs on rock radio stations make fun of punk, as they were obviously forced to play some of the bigger tunes due to listener demand. Devo's Whip It and The Vapors Turning Japanese were straight-up pop radio smashes. So was Blondie's disco-ish-slash-new-wave hybrid Heart of Glass, which soon led me backward to discover the band's less radio-friendly tunes, like the alarming Ripper to Shreds. Nick Lowe's power pop masterpiece, Cruel to Be Kind, single-handedly enabled me to unearth the whole Stiff Records culture. I discovered a treasure map with so many roads to follow. I was equally overwhelmed, enthralled, and confused. This Reagan guy had arrived in office and was suddenly the target of and inspiration for a whole wave of U.S. punk anarchy. Politically charged bands and songs began to creep into our consciousness, with not-so-subtle Reagan Youth and the UK's Crass and the Subhumans, and of course the West Coast's own Dead Kennedys and Avengers, who took fierce and unapologetic aim at both political figures and policies with such brutal imagery, both lyrical and visual, that they would make more melodic activists like The Clash and the Sex Pistols blush. At the same time, 70s arena rock was making its evolution into what would become labeled, accurately, corporate rock. And the lines in the sand were officially drawn. You picked a team. You liked Journey or you liked Black Flag. Never both. Not ever. The punk kids and the heavy metal kids did not play nicely. Though as a result of this postmodern Montague Capulet war, I never saw Motorhead, arguably a great punk band, as clad in leather as they may have been. I'm not sad I never saw Journey. Fuck them. It was around that time that friends led me to a Sunday night show on KROQ by the most non-traditional DJ I'd ever heard, Rodney Bingenheimer. At first I found both his unconventional voice and on-air awkwardness annoying. But after a while, his fanboy exuberance became not only endearing, but vital. And then there was the music. I was hearing hefty doses of bands called the Ramones and the Runaways, and that band from the news a couple of years back, the Sex Pistols. There was bad and good, some were novelty records, some were plain old weird, and some seemed brilliant. I listened intensely with the headphones on. It was my secret. The folks would be worried if they knew what I was listening to. I knew that. I liked that. That year I made bonafide punk rock friends. They were my age, but they had all these records by bands with names like the Flesh Eaters, Christian Death, the Circle Jerks, and Agent Orange. The records were harsher than what I was used to, and the company art was often shocking. They didn't get along with their parents that well. So while trying to listen to these records in darkened bedrooms after school, the tunes were regularly drowned out by the sounds of mothers and fathers and kids screaming at each other. This was the uncomfortable compromise that came with hearing new music then, and it became normal in its own weird way. These were the misfits, I guess, and they had the best and most...
Sample complete. Ready to continue?